here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Good evening, and thanks for being with us. Today we bring you a show focused on transportation planning and development issues. Adam Cooper from the UBC Trek program joins us in studio to discuss the current transportation consultation here on campus. We'll also be bringing you an interview with Vancouver City Councillor Andrea Reimer to discuss the recently opened Dunsmuir Viaduct protected bike lane, as well as other transportation and public space issues. In international news, we will bring you a report on the many challenges congressional Democrats continue to face from healthcare reform opponents, including vandalism and death threats. We'll have all this, plus your free speech radio news headlines and your weekend weather forecast coming up this hour right here on News 101. And first up, Adam Cooper, coordinator of the TREC program here on campus, is here in studio to discuss the current transportation consultation. And before we get into this discussion, today Brad Pepink and Robbie had the chance to, who's our fantastic intern here at CITR, had the chance to talk to students in the Student Union building here on campus about transportation issues, and we're first going to start out by playing some of those clips, and then we'll get right into this discussion here with Adam. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to News 101.
So I'm outside the sub with
Leanne
and
Byron.
Just wondering if you guys could tell me, how did you get to campus today?
I live on campus.
So that's pretty easy. And what about you?
I bust here.
You bust here. So did you guys know that there's actually an extensive transportation consultation going on at UBC right now?
No.
So do you think that would that change the way that you come to campus? You know, if there was more busing offered or if there was more cycling opportunities, do you think you would have changed the way that you came down?
Well, I definitely wouldn't bike here. It's like the old long time. I don't know. What would the consultation do?
Yeah, that's a good question. Do you have an input? Do you think that transportation should be changed on how students get down to campus?
Yes. If the 99 was like a direct line, that'd be sweet.
Yeah,
so it'd just save like 20 minutes, I would think.
Just want to ask you how you got here.
I take the bus from North Vancouver.
How do you feel about it?
I like it most of the time, although the 44 is pretty crowded in the morning, so sometimes you don't get a seat, but there are good newspapers to read and crosswords to do, so it's good.
Is there anything you would change or improve about the way you get here or the transportation?
Not in the mornings, but going home, often the 44 is really crowded, and sometimes they only have the smaller buses instead of the larger ones, and so my students come from downtown, can be a bit of a problem, but other than that, it's great.
Are there any like changes you think could be improved? Like, what way would you try to improve it?
In terms of the way I get here, I'm not sure what else could be done besides just making sure for the 44 during peak hours it's always the larger buses, because sometimes it, especially on Tuesdays and Thursdays, it's not. But other than that, it runs every 15 minutes, so that's as good as I can ask for.
And how about you? How do you get here?
I live on campus, so I walk.
Okay. Do you think transportation, if it was changed, would it affect you at all if there was more bus service or anything like that?
Well, living on campus is really expensive, but I do it because I hate transit. And if it wasn't so awful, I would probably live off campus.
What's your reason for hating transit?
I feel like it's really slow. Like, just it's for, like, just, I want a SkyTrain to UBC. That's all I want, really. And I feel like the 99, well, it runs really often and stuff. It's always super crowded. And I feel like if it's coming every, like, 3 to 5 minutes and it's still packed, like, I feel like that maybe is a sign that it's time to do some to think of something else, because adding buses is not really, we have the same problem. I don't like transit.
Can you tell us about what it was like to commute to UBC? You lived in Surrey, so what was that commute like?
It kind of changed day to day. So you have like your bad days and you have your good days. It really just depended on how much the traffic was. Generally, the bus system here is really good. The only thing that really was annoying, that since the SkyTrain didn't go here, it really depended on the traffic, and if there was a SkyTrain, it wouldn't change every day, like half an hour to half an hour. It sort of depended if there was a collision, like in the George Messi tunnel or rush hour. So you're really at the mercy of the road, I suppose.
And that was Brad Pepink and Rabia Saida talking with students here on campus about transportation issues and concerns. And we wanted to include this feature because in studio we have the pleasure of having Adam Cooper, who's the coordinator of the UBC TREC Program Center here on campus. And Adam, thanks for joining us in studio.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invite.
So can you first maybe we'll hold off on discussing some of those concerns from students right now, but let's just tell us about this transportation consultation that's going on right now. And a number of students did say that they had no idea that it was happening.
Well, the current consultation is really driven by the fact that we're no longer getting the underground bus terminal, and we want to turn it back to the campus community and say, okay, now that that's not the reality, where do you want your facilities to be located on campus? And we're trying to be transparent and open and engage the community. So the last month we've been reaching out to stakeholders on campus, trying to contact the students on campus. We've got a team of undergrads that are out on the streets delivering surveys. They're Twittering. We've got a Facebook page going on for this. We've got advertisements in the UBC. It's posted on UBC events. It's on the TREC website. It's on the campus and community planning website. So we're really trying to push it out through as many avenues as we can to get as much engagement as we can. We have been really successful, actually. We had a survey, and we've had over 3,000 respondents to that survey. So that's quite good in terms of getting some feedback about what people are looking for.
And can you tell us what departments on campus are involved in this? You're with UBC TREC. Maybe explain what TREC is.
Sure.
And explain to our listeners what the campus planning what campus planning here on campus is responsible for.
Sure. Well, campus planning is responsible for managing all the land uses on campus. So if you want to build something here, or we want to change how the campus is laid out, that would be driven all through campus planning. There's also the Sustainability Office and the TREC Program Center, which are sort of offshoots of the campus planning department. So sustainability is obviously focused on how do we make our campus greener, and that's through things like building standards and the new bioenergy gasification plant is a sustainability project. And then the TREC role in that whole process is transportation focused, and really the mandate of our office is to get people out of their cars, basically. We want to reduce single occupant vehicle trips to UBC. And so the U-Pass is one of our programs. We offer an employer pass for people who work at UBC. We provide cycling infrastructure on campus. We're building secure bike lockups. And so we do everything basically to try to get you to take a sustainable mode of transportation to UBC.
And I had the opportunity on Wednesday, to do a cycling tour with you and other folks. And we cycled around campus, and you explained what what things are being planned on campus and different cycling-oriented facilities, as well as future development and mixed use on campus. Let's just run through some of the major plans. Obviously, University Square is a major hub on campus, and a lot's been going on there recently. Do you want to just get into the planning for that and what it's going to look like in terms of transportation, what the intended goal is with that hub?
Sure. Well, University Square is really one of the major drivers of this whole process because, as you know, that's where the underground bus facility was planned to be located. The plans still do include going ahead with the existing components of what was laid out for the University Boulevard neighborhood. And so in University Square, that includes the new sub, which students voted to support. I think that was last year. It also includes the new alumni reception center. And so those projects are well along in their sort of development and conceptual stages. The campus planning hosted an open house in the sub, I think, maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, where they actually had sort of some massing and design concepts for what those new buildings are going to look like and what U Boulevard will look like once it's built out as it's planned. And that build-out includes some new student housing, as well as retail and sort of academic services that would be at the ground level. And the idea of that plan is to really transform U Boulevard into a gateway entrance of the university and to have it really be the sort of high street or main street of the university where you'd have this really vibrant pedestrian activity. We want to have shops and services there. We want people to be out in the public realm and kind of enjoying, you know, the beauty of the campus, I suppose.
So probably one of the, if not the most significant issue here is the fact that the bus loop, the diesel bus loop where it sits right now is supposed to be a temporary bus loop, and without TransLink being able to commit funding for the underground bus loop, it's sort of up in the air about what to do with the bus loop, whether there's one centralized bus loop or whether we have bus malls. So can you talk about both of those options or combinations thereof?
Definitely. I mean, any option that I talk about is only an idea, and really what we're trying to do through this whole process is find out what does the community want. So I can talk about potentials, but they're not necessarily set in stone or anything like that, and we really are seeking as much engagement as we can get. But you're definitely right that the current diesel bus loop is intended to be a temporary facility. Anyone that's been around at UBC for the last few years will know that it's been there for a while, but it is planned to be the Gage South neighborhood, and that would include all of the diesel bus loop as well as the parking lot that's adjacent next to the bus loop and the general services and administration building. And we've made some commitments to the University Endowment Lands community that, you know, we're going to try to mitigate the impact of having all that transit infrastructure right next to them. So the real question is, yes, if we don't have an underground bus loop and this diesel loop is intended to be temporary, where do we put these facilities on campus? And do we want a centralized facility or do we have a distributed facility? And obviously different groups are going to have different interests in that. I imagine the University Neighborhoods Association would like to see transit closer to their doorstep. Maybe some of the residences would also like easier access to transit. But then again, you have benefits of having a centralized facility, such as if you're a 99 rider, there's other buses that you can take. If the 99 is full, you can run over and catch the 17 or the 84 and the 44. Similarly, you can kind of pick and choose what comes first. So there is a benefit of having that centralized facility. Also, a centralized facility, we could provide better end-of-trip facilities there, so secure storage for cyclists, things like that. So that's really the question, I think, is where are we going to put it and what kind of a system is it going to be?
So one of the, from what I can tell, one of the major issues with having a facility that is not centralized, where you have bus malls on campus, is the pedestrian and conflicts and conflicts with buses and cyclists on campus. And by not having one centralized facility, you may have more of those conflicts. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about let's talk about cycling and pedestrian areas now specifically, but how does that play into the type of design ultimately that comes out of this consultation process?
Sure. Well, one of the major positives about having the underground facility was that we were hopefully going to separate the boarding facilities from the exiting facilities and the bus layover areas, because we're an end-of-trip line, so buses have to wait here. Drivers need to take their breaks when they're at campus. And if you want to talk about conflicts, we can just look at the existing facility and say that there's obviously problems there. We have lots of pedestrians and buses moving through the same space there, and so we can obviously do something better with that. We do have this great pedestrianized core of our campus that's limited to bicycles and pedestrians and some UBC utility vehicles as well. So the question is, as a campus community, do we want to open that space up? Do we want to see buses running down Main Mall? Do we want to detract from that sort of quiet, reflective university atmosphere that we've got? And these are all questions that I can't answer. I mean, I have my opinions about them, but we want to hear from, all the people out there on the community. And I think in terms of routing buses through a distributed system, maybe the best option is to go on the periphery of the campus where those roads aren't pedestrianized currently. But again, these are just, this is my take on it. So I don't want to put too much out there. We want to hear what other people have to say about it.
Well, let's talk about some of the changes that are in the works right now. On the tour, we got a look to see at existing secure bike parking facilities on campus. Maybe briefly, if you want to just go through those facilities, so listeners are aware that there are existing facilities for secure bike parking, and then also if you could talk about the planned secure bike parking facility in Buchanan Tower.
Absolutely, yeah. So we do have 5 secure bike cages on campus right now. They're totally free to use. You can come to the Trek office to sign up for them, and if you're listening, please do come out, because we'd love to get more people using them and riding to campus. We're building a new facility right now it's in the planning stages. Construction should begin very soon, and it's going to be in the base of the Buchanan Tower. We're doing some exciting stuff there. It's sort of a showpiece cage for us, because it really is altering the exterior of the building. So we've tried to be creative and playful, and it's an arts building. We want to be doing something that's vibrant and kind of plays up on that arts mentality in that space. So we've created some new public seating that's going to be in there. There's new lighting associated with this project in the hopes of improving the public realm. We're using the arts faculty colors in that space, and we're trying to tie into the design elements that are coming out of the Buchanan Courtyard Renew project as well. I don't want to say these things and then they don't happen, but right now the plan is that we're going to have some pretty neat facilities for cyclists in there as well. We're going to be using some double stacked bike racks that are hydraulic assisted, so we're really trying to capitalize on the space and get as much capacity for bikes in there as we can. And we've also done some other work over the last year, put down new sharrows and share the road signs throughout the campus to try to make sure that vehicles are aware that you are sharing that road space with bikes, and we are a campus that's promoting that, and bikes belong, and we need to keep reminding drivers of that.
So later on the show, I have an interview with Councillor Andrea Reimer, and we talked about the Dunsmuir Viaduct bike lane, which is now a protected bike lane that, in a similar sense of the Burrard Bridge bike lane. And so the hope ultimately is to connect Burrard to by creating protected bike lanes from Burrard all the way to Dunsmuir to create a route through downtown on protected bike lanes. So similarly, are there any plans for those types of facilities on campus where cyclists are physically protected by an actual concrete barrier from traffic and from motorized vehicles?
At this point, we have plans for where we want to have cycling routes on campus. The ultimate facility type is not decided yet. So whether that's a physically separated facility or if it's a like some of the current systems where you have a sharrow on the road that's designating this as a shared road space. It could be either way. We've looked at some interesting things. There's a Dutch design called a Woonerf, which is this sort of winding road, and there's no signage on the street. And basically the design of the road is such that cyclists and vehicles all interact together, but it's a slow moving area. And, it's been quite successful in some European cities, so we've thought about experimenting with that kind of a design. It's interesting that you raise that point. I just had a discussion with our landscape architect today about the future of Main Mall. It's going through sort of a new landscape process, and what we're hearing from some community members is that they want to see a designated cycling route down Main Mall. And then that raises the question again about, is that a pedestrian area? Is that a cycling area? Is it both? Who gets access to that road space? Is it appropriate to have a bike lane in a pedestrianized area of the campus? And so those are the kinds of questions that we're tackling throughout this process. And it's the kind of thing that we'd love to get more feedback from the community from, so that we really can proceed in a way that's going to get people what they want and ultimately get more people cycling and help us reach our sustainability targets. You know, I think, I'm not sure if you're aware, UBC just launched these new targets, right, for GHG reduction. So transportation is our number two emitter for GHGs on this campus. So promoting cycling is definitely going to help us reach those goals.
Cycling represents not an insignificant amount of trips to campus, but it's nowhere near the amount of transit rides onto campus. One of the barriers that a number of people raise is coming up to campus, you're climbing up the hill and you're here, you end up on campus really sweaty. And a lot of people just are concerned that they don't have access to showers and facilities like that on campus to be able to feel like they can get here and clean up a bit. Are there plans for more shower facilities? And maybe you can talk about existing facilities.
Absolutely. I mean, it is part of our strategy to include those sorts of facilities for cyclists, because we know, first of all, you have to have the right road facilities to get people out, but you also have to have the right stuff when they get here. So that includes racks and the secure storage areas, as well as the showers. So this year, I'm happy to say that I've put down over 500 new bike parking spots on this campus. One of the projects that I've been working on is taking a look at our policies around when we build a new building, what's required for cyclists in terms of secure storage and shower access and locker access as well. And so we looked at our existing policies. We looked at what the city of Vancouver is doing. We looked at what is the LEED requirement, because all of our buildings on campus are now being built to a LEED standard. And what we've done is kind of turn the dial up on that. And so we do have a draft policy now that we're working on getting inserted into the new campus plan. And it is quite aggressive in terms of providing showers, lockers, and secure storage. So in the future, expect that any new building on campus will be including those kinds of facilities. We're definitely pushing in that direction, and we will continue to push in that direction, as I said, because we want to meet those targets. And to get people out, you're right, you do have to have those facilities.
So quickly, people can take the survey online. They can, I assume, come to the Trek office and do it there if they'd like to. Other opportunities to take the survey? How can they take the survey, and what's the deadline for the for them to take the survey or engage in discussion on the issues?
Sure. Well, the survey, I think, is going to stay open and running for a while. You can find it through a link on the Trek website or on the Campus Community Planning website. There's also a blog there, and we've invited some sort of famous transportation people at the UBC community to weigh in on what they think are good options, and we've had a lot of good response out of that, and I encourage people to contribute their ideas there. Also, the end of the month, we have our ideas fair, which is really, we've handed this over to the campus and said, okay, you know, come to us with your best ideas. We hosted a workshop where we helped people work through some of those with some transit experts. And that's on March 30th. And there's a couple of $1,000 prizes plus two $500 prizes for the most kind of creative projects that come out of this. And really, that's the best way for people to get involved if they have a real tangible idea that they want to bring forward. Alternatively, if you just want to come out and engage in the discussion, we're totally encouraging that too. You don't have to have an idea. You can come out and tell us what you think. And March 30th is really the best opportunity for that right now.
Okay. And to finish off, what are some of the major challenges that you found working? Obviously, you're working with a number of different authorities and bodies, and even within the university, different offices and departments on campus. What are some of the major challenges, and also what are some of what do you find inspiring, and what's been fruitful from this process so far?
Sure. Well, the inspiring part for me is I've been a bike geek my whole life, and to have a job now where I actually get to try and make that better for cyclists is great. I never really imagined that those two worlds would cross paths, so that part for me is rewarding every day. The challenges that we face, you know, we're facing a structural deficit at the university, so that's obviously a challenge for everyone on the campus, is how do we do more with less? How are we more effective? How do we continue to move forward and provide these facilities given that financial constraint? And, you know, there's so many interests on campus. We're a community. We've got residents, we've got students, we've got research, teaching, all kinds of things, and we have to weigh out all those different interests. And ultimately, you know, transit and cycling, while they're critically important, we are an academic institution, and we can't trade off quality teaching for, you know, transit facilities or bike facilities. So I think that that's a big challenge, is, you know, how do we get forward on both of those fronts? And the other challenge is, you know, I'd love to go around and put bike racks everywhere and showers everywhere, but again, it's the money, and, you know, we have to respect the architecture and the landscape, and we need to work with all the other departments on campus to make sure that we're doing things that work for everyone and aren't going to cost the university more money in the long run. So those are the sorts of challenges that I deal with on a day-to-day basis.
Well, Adam, thanks so much for coming in to talk with us. We really appreciate it. Adam Cooper is the coordinator of the TREC Program Center here on the UBC campus, and he was speaking with me about the transportation consultation that's ongoing right now. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned.
The AMS Speakeasy provides information, peer counseling, and crisis support to the UBC community. Speakeasy volunteers are carefully chosen and trained to assist students in dealing with a wide range of issues, including relationship breakups, substance abuse, sexuality, and exam stress. To access our service for information or counseling, drop in to visit our desk on the north side of the sub-concourse. All drop-ins and call-ins are strictly confidential. We also have an online email referral service. If we can't help you, we can refer you to someone who can.
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
The AMS Speakeasy provides information, peer counseling, and crisis support to the UBC community. Speakeasy volunteers are carefully chosen and trained to assist students in dealing with a wide range of issues, including relationship breakups, substance abuse, sexuality, and exam stress. To access our service for information or counseling, drop in to visit our desk on the north side of the sub-concourse. All drop-ins and call-ins are strictly confidential. We also have an online email referral service. If we can't help you, we can refer you to someone who can.
Industrial noise and goth. Tune into the Vampire's Ball. Midnight, 4 a.m. Friday nights, right here at 101.9 CITR FM in Vancouver, www.citr.ca.
I can listen to them and go, this is really crystal. And people don't make music like this, and they never have, and they never will. This is really cool stuff, and people don't make music like this, and they never have, and they never will.
The music by the close to my heart, after the side of close to my heart, by the close to my heart, after the side of close to my heart, by the close to my heart, after the side of close to my heart, by the close to my heart, by the closest to my heart.
Welcome back. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. I'm Rebya Seda. Thanks for being with us tonight. The current time is 5:35, and that means it's time for your weekend weather forecast. For that, we turn to Denise Diatic, who joins us in studio. Denise, what's the situation for the next few days?
Well, it was definitely a great spring day today. I hope you got some outdoor time in. Here's your weekend weather forecast for March 26th through 28th. Tonight will cool off a bit as a lower pressure system moves over Vancouver's mainland. Expect both cloudy and clear skies with a low of 5 degrees. We're in for a likely chance of showers on Saturday, along with some wind. High of 12, low of 6 degrees. Sunday will probably also see some scattered showers with a high of 11 and a low of 7 degrees. And now, here's the answer to last week's trivia question. The highest world temperature ever recorded was 58 degrees Celsius, or 136 degrees Fahrenheit, at Al-Azizia, Libya, on the 13th of September in 1922. You could very literally bake bread outside, of course, if you weren't baked first. And, in keeping with the hot weather trend, this week's question is, what was the highest temperature ever recorded at the South Pole in Antarctica? This is a bit of a misnomer, for, in fact, it's not very warm at all. The answer will be revealed on next week's show. That's your forecast for the weekend, brought to you by the Storm Club of UBC. Currently, it's 11 degrees and mostly cloudy at YVR. For News 101, I'm Denise Diatic.
Thanks, Denise. In local news, we continue with our transportation consultation. On today's program, we're going to turn to a conversation Andrew Longhurst had earlier this week with City Councillor Andrea Reimer. They spoke Monday about cycling in Vancouver, and here is now some of that conversation.
So I want to start out by talking about the Dunsmuir Viaduct lane, the protected bike lane that has just recently opened. This comes after the Burrard bike lane, of course, the reallocation on the Burrard Bridge. And so we're seeing a number of protected bike lanes and a growing number of additions to the existing cycling infrastructure in Vancouver. And I was hoping you could comment on the significance of specifically the Dunsmuir Viaduct bike lane and in a more general context, the significance of introducing more and more of these protected bike lanes, and not only bike lanes, but a greater number of non-motorized options for citizens.
Sure. I mean, the idea of separated bike lanes isn't a new one. It's something that our our cousins in Europe figured out a long time ago that you shouldn't have one vehicle stream moving at 50, 60, 70 kilometers an hour and one right beside it moving at, you know, if you're a really good cyclist, maybe 15 or 20 kilometers an hour, and that situation is what leads both to very significant safety issues. And also because of that, you're not going to get people on their bikes who don't have a high level of confidence about their physical ability. So when we were looking at opportunities for where we could create more separation, Burrard Bridge, of course, is sort of the holy grail of separated bike lanes in the city. It's a debate that goes back 15 years now. So that was one that we had committed to in the election campaign and are very happy to see that we're at a point as a city where what used to be considered a surefire disaster actually has been a huge success in terms of cycling numbers, but also we've seen very little impact on cars as well. In terms of Dunsmuir Viaduct, it was the next sort of logical one. There's actually a piece of lane on Dunsmuir that hasn't been available to cars now for quite some time because of construction and other issues, and it just made sense to see if we could reallocate that so that cyclists coming from the east side of town would also have a safer route into the downtown core.
Now, how committed is this council to opening a greater number of these protected lanes in downtown? There aren't any of these. There's the Dunsmuir Viaduct and the lane on the Burrard Bridge. Would this council be willing to introduce these types of protected bike lanes within downtown and downtown city blocks, let's say on existing bike routes through the downtown core?
Yeah, absolutely. When we passed the motion to create the separated trial lane on Dunsmuir, at the same time we directed staff to come back with options for separated lanes that connect Dunsmuir to Burrard through downtown. And, you know, the number, if you're a cyclist and you've taken either route, the number one complaint you're going to have is, it's great when I'm on the bridge, but how do I get onto it and off of it safely? Because you still have to merge into traffic as soon as you get on or off. So, yeah, separated lanes outside of the bridges is a big priority for the council.
I was just in New York a couple weeks ago, and they've completely redesigned a number of streets, namely 9th Avenue. And the redesign creates basically... The streets are redesigned so the bike path is physically protected and a barrier created by parked cars or a physical concrete barrier, so it creates a cycle track for cyclists. Is this something that council would look into in downtown?
Yeah, we have actually Jeanette Sadek Khan, who's the Department of Transportation, the head of it in New York. She was in town, gosh, it's hard to say now, before the Olympics, I think it was actually in the fall, when she was in town and talking to our engineering staff, and she really inspired them with their how little money they've had to spend to get huge increases in both cycling but also safety. Their traffic accidents are way down there, which is something you don't have to believe in climate change or be an ardent cyclist to get on board to see increased safety.
And so looking beyond the trial for, there's going to be a trial period for the Dunsmuir Viaduct, and they're going to, council will reevaluate the situation. Is that correct?
Yeah, although after the experience of the Burrard Bridge, the motion was to bring it in and only take it out if it's not working. With Burrard, we said put it in and then we'll evaluate how it is working. Dunsmuir, we decided that the amount of money that you need to put in to do the other way around is fairly substantial, and that clearly there's both the demand for cycling and the impact on cars is nowhere near what it appeared to have been 15 years ago, so that we need to kind of modernize our approach to bringing in these projects.
And it looks like after the Olympics, one of a number of folks have commented on the fact that there's a growing sense within the city for both merchants and citizens that that people want more public space, and they want more public space that does not involve motorized transportation. And specifically, I'm thinking about the Granville Street area in downtown, and a lot of merchants have expressed an interest and called for it to be a pedestrian-only zone. Are we seeing a significant shift in the way that people think of public space in the city? And maybe you can comment on how the city is working to create that space.
Well, you know, the very first motion that I brought in when I was elected to council at the end of 2008 was about doing a car-free trial on Sundays in different business commercial areas in the city. And at the time, I mean, it certainly had broad support out in the community, but there was a noticeable anti-lobby against it. And it's interesting now, after the Olympics, to see quite a few of those people come to me and say, wow, it really works, doesn't it? And I'm like, yeah, it totally works. You do not need a car to go out and have a good time. It's not to say that everything that involves having a good time can be done without a car, but in the case of a city that's as dense as Vancouver and likely only to get denser, we need to figure out ways to provide public and recreation space, especially on the weekend when the demand for those services is very high and the demand on our road network is much lower. So why not use the streets as public spaces?
In Portland, a number of neighborhoods and the merchants in those neighborhoods asked for parking to be taken out in front of their businesses and bike corrals to be put in place. So you mentioned that the same businesses that may have been opposed initially to car-free Sundays are now coming to you. Is this a growing trend? Or is it just post-Olympics?
I think that it's been a growing trend in society generally over the last 5 to 8 years. I know as someone who's worked in environmental advocacy, after 2005, 2006, which were extremely... we had a lot of extreme weather events on the continent, and it kind of somehow seemed to wake people up to some of the challenges of global warming, that it wasn't a theoretical problem that was going to happen in the future, but a real problem that's happening right now. So I think you see like a very increased level of awareness, and then, of course, people wanting to see a response to that, and some of those responses are greener transportation and things like car-free.
Now, are fellow councillors as keen as you are with introducing some of these measures?
Well, I think I would say that I've been really pleased by the level of support they've given them. I think they've all gone through unanimously so far. But I don't know that it's their priority to bring it forward, if that makes sense. I mean, everybody has their own priorities, which is great, because somebody's got to do the child care and the housing and all the different pieces of policy.
Well, great. Is there, I think we'll leave it at that, but is there anything else that you'd like to say?
Good question. Student radio, I guess. one of the things that is very noticeable to me in public policy debates, especially when it comes to transportation, is that student voices aren't captured as much as they should be, or at all in some cases. And given the disproportionate use of transit by people, younger demographics, and especially by post-secondary students, it is a big piece that we have to work on, is how do we make sure that people who are in school 8-10 hours a day, probably working, another 6-8 hours a day, how do we get their voices heard within this larger debate when we know that it's not going to be an evening meeting?
Right. And how do post-secondary students and younger folks play into transportation issues, and how can students play a larger role in that discussion?
Well, I mean, I guess my sense is that economically students don't have the same menu of options available to them, so they can't just run out and buy the car or the vehicle that serves their needs. Their schedules are very constrained, their budgets are even more constrained, and yet by virtue of their housing, cheap housing being a long way from universities, they have some mobility challenges, right? So I think that it's such an essential voice to get there, but we're not going to get it there in the old models of consultation that we have. So figuring out how to make our process work better as a city council so that people who aren't available in the afternoon or the evening when the meetings are happening can still have a very strong voice in that process.
Well, and lastly, are there any new bike lane projects or lane reallocations that council is looking to introduce in the next year or so?
Well, the big piece will definitely be the downtown separated lanes, like how we connect up people coming from the west over Burrard Bridge with people coming from the east over the Dunsmuir Viaduct. The next piece, though, is the capital budget. So in April, thereabouts next year, we'll start to make recommendations to voters for November for them to vote on in the capital budget. And that's a very separated bike lanes aren't cheap. They're a lot cheaper than new road infrastructure, but they still cost money. So getting people, getting an understanding of where people want to see those lanes, and then also building public support for financing them is a big issue over the next year.
And in that capital budget, will funding for the streetcar be included in that?
Well, again, it's all about priorities, the like what the public sees as a priority.
Right.
So in the case of capital budgets, it's not the council that makes the decision. It's ultimately the public,
right,
the public referendum.
Would that be something that would be put forward, though?
It would have to, it would have to be part of the overall discussion, because the voters have tended to only vote for so many dollars going into capital. So if there were to be $90 million going into a streetcar, it means $90 million probably isn't going into something else. But if people had that level of support for a streetcar, then you know, taxes go up a bit, and people vote on it, and they say yes, then it's all possible.
What are your personal feelings on the $90 million projected cost of making the streetcar operational?
You know, my own thought on transportation planning, or any kind of regional, like any planning you're doing in a city, the minute you start mixing concrete and pouring it, chances are it's going to stay where it is for anywhere from 35 to 100 years. So those aren't the kind of decisions that you make in a few days, right? Like you, or even a year. Like you want you want to think, what is this area or this region going to be like in 35, 50, 100 years? In the case of the streetcar, I don't know that we've done that thinking about where it is right now, but seeing it integrated into people's thinking about the broader transportation picture, I think, is quite essential, and the success of the streetcar trial.
Well, Councillor Reimer, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you, Andrew.
And take care.
Okay, you too.
That was Andrew Longhurst in conversation with City Councillor Andrea Reimer, and we thank Andrew for that content. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be happy to present to you the latest headlines from Free Speech Radio News. That's right here on News 101, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Gonna be around my vegetables, I'm gonna chow down my vegetables, I love you most of all. My favorite vegetable.
Sprouts. It's your 75-cent coffee fix in the sub. It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies.
It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce.
It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems.
Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply.
Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right off. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots global unembedded international independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back. This is News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, your source for alternative coverage of local, national, and international news. We're reaching the end of our show, and to tie things off, here are today's headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In a very tough outcome, final results in Iraq's elections are in, and former Prime Minister Ayad Alawi's secular Shiite coalition has won a small majority of 3 seats over those taken by incumbent Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's bloc. Maliki is already calling for a recount, as were his supporters earlier today, even before the results were officially announced. The nation's Electoral Commission said this week that a manual recount is not possible. Today, the UN said the elections were credible and called for acceptance of the results. A report on bribery practices in Mexico released by the nonprofit association Trace International has found that authorities account for 85% of the country's reported bribery demands, with Mexican police officers the most frequent offenders. And official corruption is suspected behind a major jailbreak near the northeastern border city of Matamoros. Shannon Young has more.
The 41 inmates simply walked through the front doors of the high-security prison to waiting vehicles. Most were in prison for federal crimes. Two guards disappeared along with the inmates. The prison's director has been fired, and all 200 staffers are under investigation. Most of the escaped inmates allegedly have ties to organized crime. Their jailbreak comes at a time when the Gulf Cartel is said to be battling its former enforcement wing, the Zetas, for control of valuable drug trafficking territory in northeastern Mexico. The warfare has included heavy intimidation of the press in the region, resulting in very little on-the-ground coverage outside of posts on social networking sites. North of the border, the Department of Justice says that Mexican cartel activity has expanded to every region of the U.S., and the tonnage of drugs trafficked has increased, despite a $1.4 billion military aid package aimed at reducing supply. Shannon Young, FSRN, Mexico.
The Treasury Department published a new strategy today designed to help unemployed homeowners stay in their homes. The program is multi-pronged. For unemployed homeowners, lenders are required to keep payments no higher than 31% of monthly income, even if that income is derived from unemployment insurance. The program also would allow some jobless borrowers to skip payments. No new taxes are proposed to fund the program. All federal funds will come from those already allocated under TARP. The program also offers numerous incentives for private lenders to give mortgage holders a break, like forgiving part of the principal, avoiding foreclosures by encouraging short sales, and modifying second mortgages. In an effort to address the growing number of borrowers who are, quote, underwater or owe more on their homes than the structures are worth, the initiative directs the Federal Housing Administration, or FHA, to refinance. To qualify, borrowers must be up to date on their payments. The programs will be rolled out in the next 6 months. Entergy Corporation announced yesterday that it has fixed the leak of radioactive tritium at its Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant. From Montpelier, Carl Etnier reports.
Tritium from the leak at one of the oldest nuclear plants in the country was reported in the groundwater at the site on January 7th. Vermont Yankee engineers say the leakage came from pipes inside an underground tunnel. Last month, the Vermont Senate voted to block Entergy's bid to keep the 38-year-old reactor running another 20 years, past its scheduled 2012 closing date. Many senators cited the radioactive leak and their lack of confidence in plant management, who last year told regulators that the plant had no underground pipes containing radionuclides. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission says that tritium has leaked at 27 nuclear plants. They are revisiting their policy of permitting uninspectable underground pipes to carry radionuclides. Carl Etnier, FSRN, Montpelier, Vermont.
A South Korean naval vessel has sunk off the coast near North Korea. More than 100 staff were aboard the ship. 46 remain unaccounted for. An explosion was reported near the ship's stern just before it began taking on water. Its cause remains unclear. Somali authorities continued destroying makeshift dwellings near Mogadishu's main airport today. Residents of the area were notified of the plan to tear down their homes on Wednesday. Despite their protests, the demolitions, which affect nearly 1,000 people and 500 shacks, started on Thursday. Mogadishu's mayor ordered hundreds of government soldiers to begin the raid, claiming people linked with the al-Qaeda-linked Islamist rebel group al-Shabaab were hiding in the area. Bulldozers and workers with axes and sledgehammers demolished dozens of shanties yesterday. The government claims these shelters, made of corrugated iron sheets and tree branches covered with plastic sheets, pose a security threat to Mogadishu's international airport. Residents left homeless spent the night in the open and on the rubble of their raised homes. Abdullahi Hassan lost his home in the raid.
The mayor gave this harsh order to demolish our homes, and this is disheartening. It would be better to discharge us into the sea. We can't accept this, but we do ask that they give us alternative shelter.
The shanty town, just 100 yards from the fence of the airport, was the former base of the Somali Air Force. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
Those were your headlines for Friday, March 26th, and that is the end of our program for today, March 26th, 2010. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news at citr.ca. Be sure to follow us on Twitter with username CITRNews, and you can also subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. Andrew Longhurst produced this radio program, and for more news, please join us this Monday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Brad Pepink, and from the entire news team at CITR, thanks so much for listening. Stay tuned for A Hot Mess, which is right here on 101.9 FM CITR.
Take it slow for now. Here I am.